Our next case this morning is A24-0612 in the matter of the trust under the will of Carrie Bloomberg. While you're getting settled, I'll just remind you that the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes. Is there going to be a splitting of time at all? And if so, how much for who?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Are the respondents splitting their time? And if so, how much for who?
No, I think I'm going to do the entire argument.
Okay. And who are you?
Alan Eisenes.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenes. Then respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Finally, appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, counsel, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please. Go ahead.
excuse me. Good morning, judges of the Court of Appeals. My name is John Trojak. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Robert Bloomberg, Jr. I apologize ahead of time, but I have a hearing loss. So if the court's aware of that, maybe I'll hear, but we'll have to ask for a question to be repeated.
We'll speak as loud as we can. If you can't hear us, just tell us to speak even louder.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This case is not a case that coming to this court after a long trial. There was no evidentiary hearing in this matter. There are basically three legal issues. One of them is whether the settlement agreement that the court relied on in this case bars a beneficiary from information regarding costs and expenses that would be involved in transferring the corporate trustee to a new corporate trustee, and whether or not that beneficiary can ask for that information, even if there's a settlement agreement that doesn't specifically bar that trustee, the beneficiary, from that information. The second issue is whether or not in the course of the proceedings where a beneficiary is drawn into the case by a petition that specifically asks the court for direction as to whether that beneficiary's request in a letter to the corporate beneficiary is appropriate, or whether or not the court should give the existing corporate trustee direction, which is what was in the very first petition, I think it's index one, in the court record. If a beneficiary is drawn into the case and then wants to get this information from the existing trustee or from the new attempted or potential new trustee, whether that effort is for the beneficiary, for the benefit of the whole trust, and is not specific to that individual, and whether or not that individual should be able to receive their attorney's fees and costs from the trust in the course of that litigation.
So, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can we start with the first issue? It sounds to me that you're arguing two things, that the district court erred in interpreting the settlement agreement, and even if the district court interpreted it correctly, it could not reduce rights that your client has under the state laws to obtain the information he sought. Is that accurate?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's... Could you address those two points, please?
Okay. I hope I can remember both of them. The first one is whether or not the court correctly interpreted the settlement. And our argument would be that it did not, because there was nothing in the settlement that would prohibit a beneficiary from getting in the information. On the second point, I think the statute, which is 501C, 0.0813, that requires a trustee to give information to a beneficiary I don't think that is abrogated. It's a public policy, and I cannot find law that says that a settlement agreement would abrogate that right of a beneficiary. And here it's particularly important because if the court has reviewed the record carefully, there is evidence that the costs of transferring to the new trustee would be substantially greater for the trust and consequently impact the beneficiaries. And so we argue that it's clear that the statute has to be considered in terms of the beneficiary receiving the information, absent some clear waiver, which is not present in this case.
So your argument on the first point is that the district court erred in interpreting the settlement agreement because nothing in the settlement agreement prevented your client from obtaining these costs. In other words, in his settlement, your client did not agree that he would not be able to obtain information that he was requested and that he was entitled to this information under the statute.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the court, if the court reviews the addendum, addendum one is actually a court order from the judge to disclose additional information, which the appellant never received in our argument, and therefore it's clear that even given the settlement agreement, which the court already knew about by August 2nd, 2023, which is addendum one, they still required that information, so the court clearly understood that the beneficiary was entitled to information. So the second issue was the the attorney's fees and...
Can I ask you before you go to the attorney's
fees? Yes, Your Honor.
I just want to be sure you are not appealing the denial of the request to appoint or remove a successor corporate trustee that was in the original petition, correct? You are appealing the district court's decision about, on this first issue, the information that was provided and the application of the settlement agreement. Do I have that right?
Well, in a way, the original petition would be affected. The change to a new corporate trustee would be effective if the beneficiaries, excuse me, were given full disclosure as to the fees of the new successor corporate trustee. But that didn't happen. So our argument that would be that there would be, and we've asked in the pleading, there would be no successor corporate trustee until that information was disclosed and clearly had a chance to be litigated and all the beneficiaries would be informed of those differences in cost. And if they still felt that that was something they wanted to do, of course, the beneficiaries can agree to it.
And was the missing information that it was your position the trust should go out and pricing other corporate trustees and their fees in comparison with First Trust? Because my understanding of the record was that there were disclosures made about the fees that First Trust charged and that there were no hidden fees that came out of that discovery that was that the result of that order that you indicated earlier that the district court made in response to the objection. Do I have that right?
Excuse me, Your Honor. Actually, the disclosures were not complete, and if the court reviews the record, the respondent, Richard, and his attorney actively asked First State not to reveal to the beneficiaries the actual costs. So the appellant had made a request, and the court said the disclosure that actually was not made by First State Trust. It was a letter that came through the respondent. It wasn't First State Trust directly giving the information to the court, which was the order. It came through the very parties that had actively told the successor trustee not to reveal this information to the beneficiary. And that is a significant issue because you can't have a party that's threatened or told not to disclose being totally honest with the disclosure if they've been already told not to give a complete picture of what the expenses would be. And the difference is significant in the costs between the present trustee who is on a long-term contract and hasn't changed their fee arrangement for 17 years, and this new one that has said, well, we're going to charge this fee, but it's based on Dr. Henry's trust coming over.
Counsel, I want to interrupt you because your time is limited. The difficulty I'm having with your argument is, while you raise valid points about wanting to know what things are going to cost before a change is made, you raise those points after your client agreed to a settlement in which he agreed First Trust was going to become the replacement unless everybody unanimously agreed to someone else. So I'm having a hard time understanding why the district court erred if your client signed off on a settlement agreement saying First Trust is the new trustee unless everybody agrees on someone else, and then comes to court and says, I won't agree to First Trust because unless I get this fee information. I guess what I'm asking is, well, so what? The settlement agreement doesn't provide you the right to prevent First Trust from being appointed unless everyone agrees on someone else.
Our argument would be that there was a 60-day built-in period in which the beneficiaries could investigate what was happening and what the cost would be and whatever. And in that period of time, the potential successor trustee was told not to disclose to the beneficiary what was the cost.
What did the settlement agreement then say happens at the end of that 60-day period? Does it change the fact that the settlement also said it's First Trust unless everybody else agrees? Or does the 60-day just give the beneficiaries an opportunity to investigate, at which point they could conceivably say, well, we want somebody else, here's who we want instead?
It's correct that the settlement agreement would automatically go into effect after the 60 days. That's true, but that still doesn't waive the duty of the trustee or the potential trustee to disclose all full disclosure of costs and hidden fees and so on, which it really never did.
Say you got the information you wanted. So what? Let's say the fees are exorbitant, and I'm not saying they are, but you're like, wow, this is a bad deal. Well, unless you both agreed to get rid of the trustee, the fees are the fees. So, if you were so concerned about the fees, then it should have read, if either party wants to bail, either party can bail. But it didn't say that. So all this discussion about what the fees are, I just don't see, even if you found out they were terrible, it's like, well, that's, tough. Even if you know the fees were bad, what was the remedy? You couldn't have done anything about it anyway because you both had to say somebody else before somebody else comes in. So, the settlement agreement could have been written differently to deal with the subject. And if we don't get the information within X days, we're out of here and you got to try somebody else. But it doesn't say that. And don't we enforce settlement agreements according to the plain language of them?
Yes, Your Honor, but the settlement agreement provides specifically that, number one, the original petition of the appellant is not dismissed with prejudice. It's dismissed without prejudice for them to bring it back. Furthermore, the settlement agreement also says that the Bring
it back on what grounds? That you don't like the trustee that you agreed to?
Well, I guess it would be on the grounds if there had been full disclosure that the fees were exorbitant, then it would be on the basis of that issue, whether or not.
Isn't the claims you're trying to keep more related to, you know, a year from now, there's no money in the trust because the trustee engaged in self-dealing, you know, blah, 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 bad investments, yet da-da-da-da. Isn't that the claim you've got? Isn't that the claim you've got that you're talking about, not the one you're trying to tell us about? You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Appellant would still argue that even this settlement agreement does not waive the right of a beneficiary at any point in time in a proceeding to be entitled to information. Okay. And that's not in the statute. There's no case law we could find that waives it, and that would be our argument. Yeah.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Alan Eisenmuth, and I represent one of the respondents, co-trustee Richard Blumberg. To follow up on the court's questions, we have an order called a scheduling order that was referenced by counsel, dated in August of 2023, that says the parties agree. There are 17 parties to the settlement agreement, but the parties agree that First State Trust Company shall disclose any additional fees beyond the fees set forth in Exhibit E. Exhibit E was Mr. Trojak's exhibit that showed what the fees were prior to the settlement agreement being approved. We had to do that by August 16th. I filed an affidavit with the court, exhibit number 90, that attaches correspondence from First State Trust saying what you had before is all the fees and there are no hidden fees. We also attached a letter from Morgan Stanley, which was going to be an investment advisor to work with First State Trust, saying these are our fees, these are all the fees. The total fee is 0.57%. Less than 1%, and there are no hidden fees. So we don't have any issues of fees that are unreasonable.
So your argument is you complied with the settlement agreement to the extent it discussed disclosure of fees.
Yeah, the statute says the beneficiaries are entitled to reasonable information. Judge Ireland found that the information given, set forth in his order, was appropriate. So they had all the information that they needed. The settlement agreement.
Your argument as to the claim that under statute, the beneficiary had a right to this information, your argument would be we complied with the statute. He's not entitled to more.
Absolutely.
So it doesn't matter. We don't need to really be concerned about whether or not the settlement agreement was applied correctly, because even if the settlement agreement wasn't a bar, the information was provided and there's nothing more to provide by law.
There's, as Judge Ireland found in his order, in the amended order that he issued, his memorandum that went with it, he said the actions of beneficiary Robert Blumberg far exceed the scope of the beneficiary's information needed. He took it upon himself to act and assume the role of a trustee by soliciting written bids from financial institutions. This conduct is not appropriate.
I don't know if it does matter given what you just said, but how does a beneficiary effectuate the portion of the settlement agreement that allows all beneficiaries to retain and reserve their rights under Minnesota law to petition the court for appointment or removal of a successor corporate trustee? Say we were to disagree with you that the record supports the conclusion that sufficient information was provided by law, and we would need to decide whether the settlement agreement was appropriately applied. It would seem to me, at least in your counterpart's view, that that provision of the settlement agreement would allow some sort of discovery in order to support a request to petition for the removal of the successor trustee first date that was being installed by the settlement agreement. Do I have that wrong?
I think you're right, Your Honor, that there'd be the opportunity to make a motion to remove the trustee, but not to prevent the trustee from being appointed in the first place. This trustee has not yet been appointed because of the actions of Robert Blumberg making motions, and the trial court has held that at least there's a motion before the Court of Appeals, so the trial court is not actually installing First State Trust as the trustee.
Does the settlement agreement say that this provision that I just cited doesn't take effect until after the success First State is installed, that it's premature in the way that you just described?
Well, what happens in a trust matter is the existing trustee has to be discharged. And they can't be discharged until their accountings are approved, and their accountings can't be approved when there's litigation going on in the Court of Appeals right now. At least that's the issue that's been raised by Mr. Trojak. So First State Trust has not been appointed yet. When they're appointed, then I believe Mr. Trojak has a right, if he believes there's facts to show that the trustee is not acting properly, that his fees are exorbitant or whatever, they can do that. But as Judge Ireland found, all the disclosures that were necessary were made, and the fees were appropriate. And also, prior to the hearing that was held that resulted in these orders that have been appealed, every beneficiary submitted an affidavit saying, we had the information about the fees, and we still want First State Trust. So the agreement required unanimous against First State Trust, and here it was at 17 beneficiaries, 16 said we want First State Trust, and only Robert Blumberg said no. So, Your Honor, I think that the issues on the agreement and disclosures have been covered well enough. If anybody has any further questions, I'd be happy to answer it. Mr. Trojak's argument also asked for some interpretations of the trust agreement. And the trial court said, issue means what issue really means. One generation to the next generation to the next generation, that's issue under a trust. And Mr. Trojak's argument on that was, well, that's the general law. We agree that that's the general law. But we don't agree that that's appropriate because there was some certain language in the trust agreement that means that maybe it's only those brothers and sister who are still alive at the time of the trustor's death. But when he put his argument together, he misstated the trust. And his argument, if you can see it in his brief, he says, each trust shall terminate, and the trust estate shall immediately vest and be distributed to the distributee or distributees thereof at the same time as hereinafter designated, absolutely and free of the trust, not later than 21 years after the death of the survivor of each issue. Well, what he left out was the survivor of my issue, not of each issue, survivor of each of my issue, as are living at the date of my death, and in any event, at such time as there are no living issue of mine in being. The same definition of what issue is. So his argument that this trust language was somehow specifically negating the common law definition of issue isn't very good. If you look at the fact what the trust says, but his argument leaves out the key words of the trust. So it seems to me that that argument that the trial judge erred in determining what issue was and termination of the trust is inappropriate. The other argument he made in his brief was that there should be some language about what happens in the event that there is a necessity. But the language he uses, he asked the trial court to determine what the language financial means, unquote, means in the trust. As we pointed out in our responsive memos and briefs, that language doesn't appear in the trust. So he asked the trustees to be directed by the court to what the language financial needs means, and that phrase is not in the trust. The only thing that could reasonably be subsumed in his argument was that he was asking for in case of necessity, because of, in the case of necessity, the trustees have discretion to invade some principle.
And on that, the district court said this issue is not ripe. I'm not going to address it.
Correct. There was no argument. No one had made any request for anything. And it's discretionary with the trustee. And the trial court is not going to say in 2024, for some event that might happen sometime in the future, this is what a necessity is. And again, that's very common sense and makes good sense. And what the trial court did was exactly correct in denying that request for instructions to the trustee. Finally, Your Honor, the third issue that was raised by Mr. Trojak is attorney's fees. His client was not awarded any attorney's fees, even though they made a request for these fees. And he argues that, well, the trial court didn't know that I had filed an affidavit. And the trial court ruled against me under Rule 119 because I hadn't filed an affidavit of attorney's fees. Well, he's wrong. In his brief, he said, the court in the amended order still insisted that no affidavit was filed. Well, I knew that was wrong. I went back and looked at the amended order. Finding of fact 21 in the amended order says, on September 8, 2023, counsel for the beneficiary, Robert C. Blumberg, filed an affidavit related to his request for attorney's fees. So there was an affidavit filed. But what the court went on further to say, it was filed untimely because it wasn't filed with his motion papers. It wasn't filed until we pointed out in our responsive papers that it hadn't been filed. And so what the court said, it was filed just 7 days before the hearing, after the other party, my client, filed responsive pleadings. For this reason, the request for attorney's fees and costs are denied pursuant to Rule 119. But the judge went on further to say, okay, even if 119 is not abrogated, even if 119 is complied with, the petition should be denied for fees because the petition was largely, if not entirely, unsuccessful. The court also finds that many of the issues raised were unnecessary and simply created delays in implementing the party's settlement agreement. In short, quote, justice and equity, quote, do not weigh in favor of granting the request for attorney's fees and costs. That's the statute in Minnesota that deals with beneficiaries seeking attorney's fees. That statute, section 501C.1004, it says, in a judicial proceeding involving the administration of a trust, the court, as justice and equity may require, may award costs and fees, including reasonable attorney's fees, to any party from the trust that's subject to the judicial proceeding. The judge here...
And that's an abuse discretion standard of review, correct?
Absolutely. Did Judge Ireland abuse his discretion by not granting fees? In their brief at the end, in their reply brief, they argued, well, there's a case that came out called Jorgensen, and this case requires seven factors to be considered and requires an evidentiary hearing. Well, number one, Jorgensen does not require seven factors to be determined as to whether or not fees should be granted. The seven factors are, if fees are to be granted, how do we define reasonable fees? So Jorgensen clearly doesn't apply. Secondly, there wasn't an evidentiary hearing in Jorgensen either. Jorgensen was done on affidavits and oral arguments, exactly what was done in this case. So, Your Honors, Judge Ireland's order, the amended order, should be affirmed in its entirety. Settlement agreement should be effectuated. First States Trust should be named the trustee. There was no failure to disclose information about fees. In fact, the trial court said it was appropriate. Clearly, before the decision was made, all the fees were given. And we started out with that scheduling order where all parties agree to what was going to be added to what Mr. Trojak had already received from First State Trust in his Exhibit E. The instructions requests made to the trial judge, he correctly interpreted issue, and he correctly determined that there was no viable case before him to rule on, can't give advisory opinions on future events. And finally, The record is clear that the efforts of Mr. Trojak and his counsel were unnecessary, unsuccessful, and do not warrant justice and equity in awarding fees. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Trojak, sir, you'll have the last word. You're welcome.
Even though the respondent argues that there was a full disclosure of fees, I think the record is clear that the potential trustee, before the settlement agreement was signed, was told not to tell the beneficiaries what the fees would be or the costs would be. So I think that makes it totally different.
But what about the argument that the request to remove or appoint a successor trustee was premature because First State had not yet become the successor corporate trustee? And so, you know, if Judge Ireland correctly applied the settlement agreement, and if your only avenue was to use the exception to the settlement agreement to preserve the beneficiary's rights to seek appointment of a successor trustee, why isn't what your counterpart said correct about there was no basis for you and your client to seek this information in trying to appoint a successor trustee before the agreed upon successor trustee was ever seated or vested with authority?
Well, the appellant would argue that was all the more reason why there should be a full disclosure before they're seated as the successor trustee. But beyond that, even if appellant were to rely on that petition to remove language, as Justice, you have pointed out, there is a right to discovery to find out before you're going to ask for removal if there's any real basis, and certainly exorbitant fees would probably be at least a basis to argue with the court about the ultimate appointment of the
Agree that the petition to appoint a successor trustee is premature at this point?
Yes, Your Honor, because there is, as Mr. Idenis has pointed out, there is no, as of this moment, there's no actual successor associated. It's still the successor. Okay. So, and the Jorgensen case.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was there an avenue for you to have brought a motion and asked the district court to set aside the settlement? In other words, we have the settlement. There's supposed to be disclosures. I am alleging that the proposed successor trustee has been instructed not to make those disclosures. For this reason, the court should set aside the settlement agreement because they're not complying with its terms in good faith.
Your Honor, appellate would argue that that was effectively what was done when the final objection was filed with the appellant that said, don't want anything done, no appointment until we have the disclosure. So,
but the motion you brought was a petition to appoint a successor trustee to First Trust.
There was an original, there is a second petition that was filed to get the matter transferred pursuant to the settlement, and the final moving paper filed by the appellant was an objection to that. So, and in at least...
Well, it was objection to annual and final, if I think I'm looking at the right one, accounts, and petition for order appointing successor corporate trustee. So it was a... I mean, that's how I understood that your argument was framed, is that you were taking advantage of the exception in the settlement agreement for beneficiaries to pursue their rights under such a petition.
Yes, yes,
but
that would be
you
correct.
You just agreed that petition was premature.
Yes, because there had been no actual transfer. And actually what Pellant was trying to do is head that off, because that's a very expensive process to change the corporate trustee to another one, and then and then bring them back. So it almost had to be done for the benefit of the trust, so there weren't a lot of other expenses in transferring and so on. And one last thing on the Jorgensen case, at least the one that I've got, which is 10 Northwest 3rd, 502-2024, it does say in 506 and 507 that even if the determination of the trial court is not in agreement with what the moving party, the beneficiary, or the party asking for fees who is not the trustee, even if they don't succeed, they're entitled, in this case, to attorney's fees, or that does not bar them. And it also says that the award of attorney's fees under that statute is broad under 1004. So with that, unless there's some other question.
I don't think so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, judges. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We will issue our decision in 90 days.